May it please the court, the factual conclusions arrived at by the trial court in this case were clearly erroneous. If you look at the essential facts determined by the court, they don't match the record at all in this case. The court below found that Officer Graham arrived at the door. There was a conversation. The conversation included where are the people, and he said, "My mom and Brandon aren't here," which wasn't said. And then the court found that Officer Graham asked permission to come in, and the boy, Devontae Garcia, just opened the door. Well, if you look at the transcript, none of that occurred. Officer Graham said, "We knocked. We announced probation and parole. He opened the door. We walked in." And then after he walked in, he said, "Is your mother or Mr. Wild or Brandon here?" And he said, "No." And that's what happened. The court's finding of fact below, it matches almost word for word, substantially similar to one of the paragraphs in the state's pretrial brief. And but it doesn't match the facts that are in this case. They don't.
But even before the door opened, why wasn't there a reasonable suspicion based on what the officer knew that your client was in violation of the no contact order by living there?
Well, that's not why they were making the search. And that issue has been addressed by this court in Culver. In Culver, there was an issue about a search based upon a anonymous informant. This court determined that informant didn't provide sufficient basis for the tip. The state argued, well, there were alternate reasons because previously there was a positive urine screen and a curfew violation, but the probation officer didn't take any action on that. And this court found in Culver, it's not important what could have been a basis for a search on a prior time. It was the reason for the search at this time.
Well, that's what I'm asking. Didn't the officer believe, based upon the probation and parole records, that your client lived at this address?
Yes.
And the officer also knew that Garcia lived at this address based on the same record?
Yes.
And the probation officer knew that they were not permitted, your client was not permitted to have any contact with Garcia?
Correct.
So why does that not provide a reasonable suspicion that there was a violation of the no contact order?
Well, to be a violation, you would have to know that there was contact. When this officer approached that door, he didn't know if Brandon Wallace was going to be there. He didn't know he was still living there. The office notes, which are the official record for probation officers, showed that Brandon Wallace said that he was living at a different location. His assigned probation officer just did not change the official address. But in the office notes, it showed that he had a different address because of the pending charge. But just because, regardless of whether his official address was still the same address of Ms. Garcia, that doesn't mean there was reasonable suspicion to believe he was there. And I specifically asked Officer Graham, when you went there, did you have any basis to believe that there was a violation, that there was anything criminal was going on? He said, no, we were there for a compliance check. We were going to see if he was still there. And then if he was still there, then they would have violated him. But they didn't know. There was no articulable basis to believe that he was there.
So the record reflects that the police testimony is, at the time I got to the door, I was simply doing a compliance check.
Compliance.
And there was no, and is that undisputed that that's what the record says?
Yes. And that's why the trial judge's findings are clearly erroneous, because he said there was this conversation. Part of it was that is your mom and Brandon still there? And then there was a quote that's not in the record. And then the next sentence is, before he enters the door, can I have permission? And then Devontae just opens the door. That's what the trial judge found. And none of that is found in the record. Graham said on direct, I knocked, he opened the door, he didn't say anything, I just came in. On cross-examination, I said, well, so you didn't have any conversation. He says, well, I did after I entered. And after I entered, I said, is Brandon and your mom there? And all he says is no.
Could you give us the record site?
While you're looking, let me ask a question. What relief are you seeking? Are we supposed to reverse, or should we remand it so that the trial judge can decide the question of whether Devontae Garcia gave valid consent?
Well, I think that on the record, since the state has the burden to show that this child had authority to give consent.
He's 14 years old or so. Isn't that enough in and of itself?
No. I mean, under the test and cook, there are four factors. One of them is age. One of them is the understand that you have the authority to decline to let the officers in. And there's other factors. This happened in a split second. Whatever version you believe, he opened the door, they came in, and there was really no discussion until after he was already in. I mean, 14 years old to think that you can let a stranger in your house, you know, when it's a, I would suggest when you have three officers in circumstances that's consistent with a show of force.
I distracted you from the task you were performing for Justice Jacobs.
Your Honor, are you looking for...
Well, you started out your whole argument saying that the finding of fact was clearly erroneous, as the record shows that, and I'm just asking what the record site is.
My statement of facts highlights this in Appendix 30, Transcript 32 to 34. It's in my statement of facts. I highlighted it because it is so contrary to what this court found. And if you look at the court's decision, if you compare that to one of the first paragraphs in the state's pretrial brief, it's virtually identical.
Let's go back to this issue of consent. There I think, two times when consent's relevant. One is entering in the first place.
Right.
The second is when the child said they're not here. The record shows the policeman says, I didn't believe the child. People don't tell me the truth in the past. And so I'm going to sweep the apartment to make sure no one else is here. And there's no question that that policeman did the sweep on his own, that there was no consent to sweep the apartment.
Right.
So the only consent issue is stepping in the door.
The issue is, did he have authority to enter?
Right. Okay. I just want to make sure that the sweep was something that was not asked for. That the policeman said, for my own safety, I swept the apartment to make sure no one was there because I didn't believe the child.
Right. And the lower court validated that because for safety reasons, but I think to do a protective sweep, you have to have a reasonable basis to believe that somebody's in there and there may be a danger. And there were, those facts don't appear.
Well, wait a second. Didn't the officer say, I had a reasonable basis to believe that because the child told me the opposite?
Well, the child told the truth. He said, my parents aren't here.
I understand that, but wasn't the officer's explanation for why he had a suspicion that one or both of them were in the house is because the child told him the opposite.
Well, no, because I don't think you can assume that everybody lies just because they're associated with a probationer. That's what the judge seemed to validate, and that they had the probation officer get up and testify that, well, we've learned in our experience that families of probationers often lie. But I don't think, as a matter of law, that can be supported. I mean, to support that, especially in a case where the child was telling the truth, you know, it's basically assuming that every person associated with the probationer is not going to tell the truth. So automatically, you have reasonable suspicion to act upon your subjective belief regardless of what that person says. This person told the truth. There was no basis to believe that he was lying.
Other than stereotyping, right?
Other than stereotyping.
Is the record clear that prior to entry, the probation and parole rule 7.2, where you have to get the supervisor's permission to search a house, that that was not complied with?
Well, I don't think they weren't there to do a search. They were there to do a compliance check, so they didn't have to go through that step. Once the officer was in and he did the sweep and he looked in the bedroom and he saw the drugs.
Can you go in and do a compliance check without consent?
I don't believe so.
Compliance with Rule 7.2?
I don't believe so, Your Honor.
Okay, so what I'm asking is, essentially, is if we agree with you that there was not a basis to enter because of failure to substantially comply with Rule 7.2, the critical issue is consent, which the trial judge did not reach.
That's right. And the court would have the option of remanding it back to address that issue, or it could, on the record, because it is the state's burden to establish that the child had authority, and under the Cook test, none of those factors were established by the state. I mean, they didn't even...
Well, help me understand where that gets us. Let's suppose we remand it, and the Superior Court says, yes, the child said, you can come in. So we then have a person who's permitted to stand inside the door. What you're trying to suggest is that there was no basis for the sweep and everything else, which seems to be independent of the consent. So even if there's consent, how does that affect your case? If the child said you can step inside the door?
Well, if there was consent, and again, I need to repeat and reemphasize that there was no discussion until after Graham was already in the door.
Right.
So it would have had to been some kind of tacit consent interpreted by the officer. But once he's legitimately in, then my argument is that the officer did not have authority to go in and search the bedroom. He didn't ask for consent, and my argument would be that even if he asked, a 14-year-old child doesn't necessarily have the authority to give consent to search.
Well, that's my question. Is the record unclear on what I'm calling the second consent? I thought there was only one consent.
There was only...
And that the sweep for protective purposes was going to be done by the officer no matter what, because the officer already didn't believe the child.
Right.
So if you don't believe the child when he says no one's here, you're not going to say, well, do you mind if I search the bedroom?
Right. Well, there was no consent. That's correct.
All right. So then my question to you is, a remand to find out whether there was consent to stand in the door is not going to decide this case. The case turns on what was done subsequent to the entry. And you're saying that even if there was consent to stand inside the door,
right,
you couldn't do everything else, and it's the everything else that really led to the discovery of the evidence that you want to suppress.
That's correct.
Right, and to follow up on that, you know, if we take the sweep in isolation from whatever occurred before the officer got into the house, I gather your position is that under the probation and parole regulation, officer would either have to have specific permission from his supervisor to do the sweep, or would have to have independently a reasonable suspicion that there were drugs in the house.
Reasonable suspicion that either people were in the house, he was doing the sweep to see if anybody was there.
Okay.
Not to search for contraband.
Okay.
And I just think that there has to be reasonable suspicion to support that.
What about the, as I recall, there was a car in the driveway?
Yes.
How does that fit in with the relevant facts here?
Well, according to Graham, it doesn't fit in because Graham testified, I didn't see the car as I was approaching. The car came into play after he already went in to the bedroom, found the drugs, contacted the supervisor, asked for permission to do the initial search. After he does the initial search, he finds the title to the car and the keys. Makes a second request to search the car. And the fact that he didn't ask for permission to search the car as part of the first request, it confirms that the car really wasn't on his radar. He testified, he walked up to the house, he didn't look around, he didn't see the car.
Well, wait a second. There's affirmative testimony that when he went in the door, whether he was invited in or not, but when he walked in the door at that point in time, he didn't realize that there was a car in the driveway or in the garage or wherever.
Yeah, he didn't notice the car until after he came across the title and the keys in the bedroom.
Okay, so would it be fair to say that the only basis for having a reasonable suspicion that there was a possible violation of probation going on was the fact that the officer didn't believe the child when the child said that his parents were not there?
He's already in when he finds out that information. So the entry has already occurred. So whether
when did he find out about the car?
Excuse me?
When did he find out about the car?
I infer that after he found the title and the keys, because in the bedroom, because he gets permission to do the search of the bedroom. He didn't ask for permission to do a search of the car, which I suggest he would have if he was aware of it.
I'm sorry, but let me make my question clear. Did he physically see the car in the driveway when he went into the house?
I don't believe so. I addressed that in my statement of facts. He went right up to the door, didn't search around, didn't mention the car. The car wasn't an issue until after the first search. So I don't know how the trial court could have found that could have been an issue when it wasn't in the probation officer's mind as he enters the house.
But the trial court used that as some part of the basis to have reasonable suspicion, right?
Yes. He supported it based upon the statement of the child that, quote, my mom and Brandon aren't here, which is not in the record, and the car. And what he says is the presence of the car may have meant, not probably, but may have meant that they may have been there. And it was just so speculative. What really is disturbing is that it wasn't a stated basis by the probation officer. This probation officer made it very clear why he was there, what he considered, and it wasn't because of the car.
Well, maybe I'm confused with the way the record is. As I understand it from you, the police officer said, I showed up at the door, I had no reasonable articulable suspicion of anything I was there for a compliance check. And I opened the door, or the child opened the door, I stepped inside and asked if these two people are there. The child says no.
Right.
And once again, the officer is not saying he has a reasonable, articulable suspicion of anything.
Right.
What he says is, I didn't believe the child.
Right.
So I swept the apartment to make sure no one else was there.
Right.
So there's no record anywhere where anybody says they have a reasonable, articulable suspicion of anything.
That's right.
It's simply, I'm there for a compliance check, and I want to make sure no one else is there.
Exactly. And that's why the lower courts...
But is that determined objectively or subjectively? I mean, do we look to determine whether there are objective facts or circumstances that could support a reasonable, articulable suspicion, or must we have a statement from the officer, I actually had a reasonable, articulable suspicion, and this is what it was?
I think if the standard is reasonable suspicion, it has to be objective. You may have a hunch, but you can't just...
So the fact that the officer says I was there for a compliance check as a matter of law does not preclude a determination of the existence of a reasonable, articulable suspicion.
Well, it has to, the compliance check can lead to reasonable suspicion once you determine other facts, but just the fact of, I'm going to do a compliance check, I'm just going to check out the household, see if people are here, who's here, that's not...
You're saying he couldn't do the compliance check unless he had either permission from his supervisor under the rule, or... had at that moment, that is before beginning the sweep, a reasonable, articulable suspicion.
No, there's two. Probation has two policies. There's one for compliance checks. There's one for doing searches. Okay, the one for doing searches really doesn't come into play here until after he's in the bedroom and then he seeks permission pursuant to that policy. He complied with the policy. The policy for compliance check authorizes an officer to go and meet and check out the residence, but it's limited.
But he has to have permission under their rules to get in the door.
Not from the consent. You just can't break. Like if they refuse to open up the door, there would be no authority to break the door in and go in. If the child said, "I'm not letting you in," if he didn't consent, they couldn't come in.
Okay, so he didn't need supervisor's consent to do the compliance check.
That's correct.
That's right.
What did he need, if anything?
Well, he didn't need anything to do a compliance check, but to enter into the house, he either he needed consent. If he gets consent, then he needs he doesn't have authority to go and search the bedroom.
Do you want to save your remaining time?
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you.
And I'll say hello because it's not quite morning and not quite afternoon.
I had to cross out afternoon when you came out earlier, Your Honor. May it please the court, Justice Holland, Justices, good afternoon. Paul Wallace on behalf of the state. The Fourth Amendment, of course, we all know protects from unreasonable searches and seizures. And it's premised on expectations of privacy that society's willing to recognize. And this court has held, and the United States Supreme Court has held, that probationers have some diminished but not non-existent expectations of privacy in certain areas and certain activity. What Brandon Wallace wants to do is to expand that so that the expectation would be that he, as a probationer, can be legally banned from a place and activity by a court, in this case a no-contact order, that he can tell the probation office that he's not doing that anymore. But the probation office can do absolutely nothing to ensure if that's true. The state suggests that there are reasonable procedures in place, and Mr. Monica discussed some of them, and discussed what he's really trying to conflate here, and that is a Rule 7.3 home visit, which is in the probation rule or procedure 7.3 is in the appendix at A63 and 64, with what Justice Ridgely mentioned earlier, 7.9, the administrative search. Administrative searches are based really to look for evidence of actual criminal activity. I think my probationer has drugs. I think my probationer has guns. The cases of Culver and Sierra where they get tips that they're engaging in other types of behavior. This was really...
Help us understand what they can do on a compliance check.
Yes.
Let's have a hypothetical where the same facts, except when the person arrives at the door, and there's an adult at the door. And the question is Brandon here? And the answer is no, Brandon's not here, from the adult. Now, what can the probation officer do?
If, and I think that, if I may add just one fact to the court's hypothetical, because I think it's important here, if they believe that is in fact their home, if that's their reporting address, as it was here, it was 79 Chauncey Street, was still in Delgis as the probationer's address because they hadn't changed it yet, and that's explained in our appendix, actually during the contested VOP hearing, because they needed to verify that, in fact, he was moving somewhere else. And that's what part of this was, look, this person shouldn't be here. And because he shouldn't be here, we need to check, is he still here? To get to the court's specific question, what can they then do? I'd suggest Rule 7.3G, when it talks about the purpose is, they're there to verify the offender's residence, observe the home environment, identify the interpersonal relationships of residents, identify any relationships not permitted, and ensure the officer is not involved in any criminal activity. And it then says they can do a walkthrough. And it specifically makes it clear that a walkthrough is different than a search. And in fact, if you look
I understand. But let's just stick with my hypothetical so that I can understand your view. Or, you know, the actual authority the probation officer has. And the adult says, no, he's not here. And then the probation officer says, well, I want to do a walkthrough anyway. And the adult says, well, you can't do that. Then does the probation officer say, well, the rules are, this is his address. As a probationer's address, I can walk through whether you like it or not. Please step aside.
I believe they can. I believe that's part of the contract of probation when they sign up. As there was some discussion about the fact that the probationer signs up and says, look, you have to understand, you have to allow a certain amount of access. And even if that third person says, I don't want to, part of taking the probationer on into that residence, whether they would have had actual authority to otherwise keep police out and other circumstances out, I think that when the probation officer says, look, notwithstanding you telling me he's not here, I think I need to, I wish to do a walkthrough, and I want to do a walkthrough.
So the state's view then is this idea of consent is irrelevant, the idea of a prospective sweep is irrelevant, because at the end of the day, neither of those were necessary. This person was on probation. That was the address, although the probation officer was mistaken about the change or unaware of the change, but in good faith went to the address and had authority to do a walkthrough whether anyone liked it or not.
That's the state's position, that yes, he would be able to do that.
Is that argued below?
Yes. In fact, it was argued, it's specifically argued if the court looks, B24 of the, it was our re-argument answer in part, that our primary argument was that really this was that type of compliance check under Rule 7.3, not under 7.19.
Okay, so just to follow up on Justice Hong's question, the probation officer could knock on the door, and whether it's an adult or a child that answers, he could just say, I want to do a walkthrough without asking permission, step inside and then do the walkthrough?
Yes. I suggest Rule 7.3 permits that, and that's part of one of the lesser expectations that probationers have in their home.
Okay, so the central point, and I just want to make sure I have it right, is that the state's position is that there need not be any consent by any occupant of the house for the parole officer, probation officer, to do a walkthrough, that is to enter the front door once the front door is open and then do the walkthrough.
Yes. And I think it's important to look at...
Can I alter the hypothetical a little bit? In this case, the records which weren't updated showed that the probationer did not reside there, correct?
He claimed not to reside there any longer,
okay.
Yes.
And there's no dispute but that he wasn't there, and the person who answered the door said, he's not here. You're saying that's fine, he can still walk in and do a walkthrough. And he can do that because that was listed as his residence? Is that the reason?
That is listed still as his residence with probation until they change it, because they hadn't verified and ensured the suitability of the first one. In fact, the probation officer at the contested VOP hearing said, I specifically didn't do that because he gives me this off the cuff and I have 30 days basically to check and ensure, verify this is going to be his true address,
well,
the fifth street address he eventually gave.
I want to go back to Justice Berger's question and your answer, but you mentioned the VOP hearing twice, and I understand that, but we really need to focus on this particular record and what was presented to the Superior Court in this criminal case.
Yes.
Okay, so let me go back to where I was trying to kind of find out where the lines are. Let's assume that in absolute good faith, the same probation officer knocks on the house next door and says, you know, are your mother or Brandon there? And the kid says, no. Maybe the kid knows that Brandon lives next door, but whatever, the kid says no. At that point, again, he believes that this is the right house. Is he allowed to do a walkthrough? And if he finds drugs in there, is that, can that be suppressed?
Well, I guess being as we don't have a good faith exception here in Delaware, it might be a problem, Your Honor. But, I mean, I would suggest that if is there some other type of liability for the officer for getting it wrong, there may be. But is it a Fourth Amendment violation of that second homeowner? Honestly, I'm not as up to date on the got the wrong house on a warrant or other type of activity that he normally would be permitted to engage in under the Fourth Amendment.
Okay, well, what I'm trying to get at is that you seem to be saying that even if all of his facts were wrong, he gets to walk into this house and look around because there was something in the file that said that this is where the person lives.
Your Honor, I apologize if it seems I'm saying if he can get all the facts wrong. He didn't have, actually, in reality, any fact wrong here. Brandon Wallace, his reporting address was 79 Chauncey Street, still with probation and parole. He had said, I intend to live somewhere else when he last met his probation officer. Turns out that wasn't true. In fact, he was still staying there at 79 Chauncey Street. And when he was met at the door by the child, who was a 14-year-old who also was on probation, so there's some knowledge of probation officers and their situations and their contact with that home on behalf of this 14-year-old. Devonta specifically testified, I told him, meaning Officer Graham, Brandon wasn't here. Shavonta, the young woman, I believe she's 13 or 14 at the same time, the daughter said, they, meaning the officers, asked for Brandon Wallace, and Devonta said, he's not here right now, he stepped out. So as the officer is sitting there, he has every good reason to believe, I have this address, they're telling me in so many words, he still lives here, he stepped out, he's not here. And Officer Graham said, is that when he asked, is your mom and Brandon here? Garcia's son replied no. So in the normal course of communications, putting ourselves where the probation officer is at the time, he said this is the address. Officially, that was still the address. It wasn't going to be changed until they verified that he truly did live somewhere else. And that's part of the reason he's there.
Distracted you with these hypotheticals. And tell us why the Superior Court's ruling was correct in this appeal, based, you know, on the facts.
I suggest that it's the court actually held the state to a higher burden than it needed to by saying that there was reasonable articulable suspicion. It didn't even have to find reasonable articulable suspicion. I'd suggest that it could have found simply this was a permitted walkthrough under Rule 7.3 to check compliance.
What in the record supports a articulable suspicion?
I would suggest the knowledge, first of all, that was the address he was still reporting, that there was the offensive touching and the noncompliance with bond and the no contact. And subsequent, he said he already knew at that point that he had violated that no contact once since it had come into play. Him getting to the home and asking, is Brandon Wallace here? And those three interactions as heard by three different actors, which were, he's not here right now, but this is where he lives, which would have been a violation. So I suggest right then and there, that's reasonable and reasonable articulable suspicion.
Was the officer still outside when that was said, or was that said inside?
That's unclear. It's either as he's walking, the officer says what happens basically is Devonta opens the door, and he takes that as come in, and that he's standing right there, and either as he's coming in the door, right there at that doorstep, and whether it's while he's stepping in, after he has just stepped in, it's not totally clear as to when that is said about is your mom and Brandon here, nor do Devonta or Shavonta place that timeline as far as is he already stepped in, where is he standing, when that is asked, but it's right there at the door.
Why do you think, if this rule is so well established, that if there's a compliance check being carried out and you can walk in and look around, that the officer said I was doing a protective sweep? You would think these experts who are trained probation and parole officers would have said to the young man, thank you, and I understand you said he's not here, but I'm going to walk around anyway. And even at the witness stand, he never said, I walked through to make sure that the compliance check, as part of the compliance check, he said I went through for a protective sweep.
Why he uses that terminology, Your Honor, I can't tell you, other than I think there's multiple concerns going on. One, is this child telling me the truth, or this person at the door telling me the truth? Is this person truly still here? We already know that he's been in violation before, in fact, this is the address he's still claiming, this young person.
To Justice Ridgely's question, though, I mean, what's the state's position on how this case should be decided? If, in fact, there was no reasonable articulable suspicion and there was no basis for this protective sweep, based on the evidence in the record, is it your position that this appeal should be affirmed anyway because, based on the rules, he was allowed to do a walkthrough, and if he did a walkthrough, and objectively he could have done a walkthrough, the fact that he justified what he did for two reasons that aren't supported by the record really is irrelevant?
Well, I think it always is the objective. Is there an objective basis? All Fourth Amendment questions come down to an objective basis for doing what he did. And I do think that there is in the record, in fact, Officer Cronin, who helped to draft the various procedures, testifies at the hearing. I don't have the site. It's in the A appendix. As to the difference between the two.
At the criminal hearing or the violation of probation hearing?
In the actual suppression hearing, Your Honor. We put the contested BOP in the B appendix to explain a little bit more about why the address had not been changed. But the entire suppression hearing is in the A appendix. But Officer Cronin did testify to there about the difference between these two. So...
Now, has this 7.3G, has this been litigated and upheld by the Superior Court as consistent with the Fourth Amendment?
Not that I am aware of, Your Honor.
And this court hasn't either, then?
Not that I am aware of, no. There's been... most of the situations we've had to deal with, like I said, Culver and Sierra, are situations where they're using 7.19 because there's a real question as to whether you're going to arrest the person or search. And if you look in 7.3, one of the things that 7.3 does is it distinguishes between administrative search and says, look, you can't go into closets, you can't go into bureaus, you can't do any of those types of things. And if you do notice that there's some type of contraband or something like that that you see in plain view, then you go to 7.19. You go back, you pull out, you go to your supervisor, as happened here.
Yeah, I believe you stated earlier that you did argue to the trial court your interpretation of 7.3.
Yes, sir.
It appears that the trial court did not agree with you and went out of his way to find that there was consent and reasonable suspicion. Is that a fair statement?
I think the court was more silent on consent, more vocal on reasonable articulable suspicion, but didn't necessarily...
Well, interpreted the record so that it certainly supported a conclusion of consent on the part of the child.
Yes.
And then went on to find reasonable suspicion, with none of which would have been necessary, according to you, if the court had agreed with your interpretation of 7.3.
Yes. one last matter as to the car and when there was knowledge of the car. That's just not clear in the record at all as to when he actually, you know, did he walk in not even seeing the car? Did he see the car later? What the record does bear out is they turned their attention to the car eventually because they found the title inside and then said, well, we better look at this car because it belongs to Brandon Wallace. And that's when the real first mention of the car is there. Whether they saw it in the driveway and whether that was part of them believing there's an adult here and maybe I should believe this child less or not, it just was never asked and it really isn't clear. So that's all I can tell the court on that issue. If there are any other questions from the court.
Thank you.
With respect to policy 7.3, the home compliance check, home visit check, it does not address the authority to enter when there's no consent. It just doesn't address it at all. And in fact, I was reviewing the transcript when Officer Cronin was talking about this policy, and I asked him, well, what's the situation when a child answers the door and does it address it? And he says, well, it doesn't address it. It's fact-driven. And so
was
the
was there any reliance on the so-called contract, whatever it is, that a probationer signs and basically gives consent in advance to a home visit? Does it do that? I don't know.
Well, you balance that against the defendant's Fourth Amendment rights to protection against, you know, limited protection, and under Griffin. Regardless,
during this exchange with the officer, did he ever say, you know, I could just go in, it didn't matter? Did he assert his construction of 7.3G as saying I could go in whether they like it or not?
No.
I understand that to be my authority?
No. I questioned him about the consent form that the probationer signs, and I said, well, the probation officer gives you authority to do the search. Is there any limitation to that? And Cronin said, yeah, the constitutional limitations. So,
well, that's where we blended two things in this case. One is searching, and we know,
yes,
what all the procedures are about searching.
Right.
But the other is, what can you do with a compliance check? And what we have here is someone who wasn't purporting to do a search. They were purporting to do a compliance check and wound up with evidence in plain view.
Well, the state's suggesting that there's unlimited authority to enter, regardless of consent, regardless of reasonable suspicion. I don't see any authority in that in 7.3. I don't think it would be a wise policy to give a probationer that probation officer that authority.
You're saying it's a gap. It isn't addressed at all in 7.3.
It's not addressed.
Great. Well, thank you both
thank
very
you.
Much. We'll take the matter under advisement and we'll recess.